The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have left tens of thousands of American soldiers with service-related injuries or illnesses. The Defense Department has been trying to match wounded soldiers with employers who can see beyond their disabilities. Kansas Public Radio's Brian Thompson paid a visit this week to a career fair at Fort Riley, Kansas.
The conference center at Fort Riley is abuzz with activity as a few hundred soldiers, both in and out of uniform, meet with employers to talk about jobs. These troops are planning careers after the military while coping with the challenges of their service-related disabilities. Lieutenant Colonel Andy Price heads Fort Riley's Warrior Transition Battalion, which helps wounded soldiers prepare for civilian life.
Some of them have limited mobility issues. Some of them have concerns that they may not be marketable in the civilian environment. So while they are here, they get to go around and do applications and interviews on the spot and realize that there's a future for them.
Sergeant David Womack served 3 tours of duty in Iraq as a military policeman. He says he returned home with a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder.
The stuff that, you know, not only, you know, myself saw, but everyone else is seeing over there, you know, it doesn't even take very much to have a big impact. In relation to other wounded warriors, I would think mine is not very as severe, but it definitely impacts in jobs.
As he makes his way past the job tables, Womack stops at a display from the world's second largest defense contractor.
Hello.
Hey there, young man. How are you doing?
Not too bad. My name's
Good.
David.
Okay, so. David, Dwayne Hardesty. I'm with Northrop Grumman Corporation.
Okay.
Dwayne Hardesty is the point man for Northrop Grumman's Operation Impact, a program that tries to find jobs for severely wounded soldiers.
Okay, 8 years service, mm-hmm. And what's your MOS?
31 Bravo, military police.
Okay, so you're law enforcement.
Yes.
Is that kind of the career field that you want to stay in?
I'd like to.
That's a good one.
Hardesty tells Womack to email him his resume and then directs him to a website where he can explore jobs he might be qualified for.
Now, it's very structured. Why did we do that? Because a lot of the warriors we're working with, maybe they got PTSD, and so what happens is you need a lot of structure.
Hardesty is a retired Army colonel, so he's right at home talking to soldiers. He says he's been to all but one of the 30 Hiring Heroes career fairs held across the country in the past 5 years. Hardesty likes Fort Riley's because it includes smaller, local employers like those represented by Leo Converse, who's hiring for 15 sales jobs at a local chain of car dealerships.
We don't pay attention to the disabilities. We're primarily just looking for good people. For one thing, they always know how to show up on time.
Reliability is just one of the skills former soldiers often bring to the table. Some of the employers here say career fairs like this allow them to both hire good workers and to show gratitude to these soldiers for their service. For NPR News, I'm Brian Thompson in Salina, Kansas.
You're listening to NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. Today, Greece formally asked its European neighbors and the International Monetary Fund for an emergency rescue package, $56 billion worth. It was an embarrassing move for the Greek government, which had hoped to delay a bailout request until after this weekend's IMF meeting here in Washington. But investors had already begun betting that Greece's problems could lead it to bankruptcy. As NPR's Tom Gelton reports, that's bad news for Greece and for any other government struggling with debt burdens.
The IMF and World Bank annual spring meetings here could have been a time for celebration. When finance ministers gathered here last year, they were looking at shrinking world output and sharply rising unemployment. Since then, the global economy has recovered faster than anyone thought it would. Growth forecasts have been revised upward. But Greece's problems are casting a shadow over this weekend's meetings. Other governments with big debt loads worry they could be next. One set of concerns has been replaced by another. IMF Research Director Olivier Blanchard pointed this out in a news conference.
A year ago, the risk was that private demand would collapse, leading to another Great Depression scenario. So the priority was to implement fiscal stimulus programs and avoid this catastrophic scenario. This we did. 1 year later, however, the risk has shifted location.
There's a whole story in this statement that risk has shifted location. It sums up what's happening in the global economy. A year ago, the crisis was located in the private sector. Banks were failing, factories were closing, consumers weren't spending. The situation on that front is now better. But now the problems are in the public sector. Whole governments are in danger of going bankrupt. Greece is the perfect example. New data released yesterday showed the country now owes an amount equal to 115% of everything its economy produces each year. A bailout from the IMF and the European Union would help Greece make its debt payments, and officials here expect the package will be approved. But the IMF managing director, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, yesterday said the Greeks themselves will have to make big sacrifices.
I mean, they need to solve the problem in which they are. There's no way, no silver bullet, to solve it in an easy manner.
Greece is an extreme case. Its creditors lost faith in its economic management. But debt is a problem even for many apparently rich countries, if not now, then in the years ahead, when governments face rising pension and health care costs. Uri Dadoush is director of international economics at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Pretty much everywhere in the industrialized world, the issue of large budget deficits, rising debt levels, and the aging and demographic trends are all pointing in the wrong directions.
Note, he says, the industrialized world. The developing countries like China, Brazil, and India have come through the economic crisis in better shape. They don't have the debt burdens that European countries and even the United States have. And they are rapidly gaining ground on the rest of the world. Dadoush, a former senior official at the World Bank, says the trend actually began years ago.
The developing countries are continuing to grow 3-4% faster than the industrial countries. Of course, 3-4% difference has already been going on for close to 10 years. And if you're talking about another 10 or 20 years, which I think is likely, then you're talking about a historic transformation.
Old geo-economic distinctions no longer apply. We used to say that Western industrialized countries were the first world, the second world was the communist countries, the old Soviet bloc, and the rest, the poor countries, neither in the East nor the West, were the third world. But Robert Zoellick, the World Bank president, says last year's global financial crisis showed how the economic landscape has changed.
If 1989 saw the end of the second world with communism's demise, then 2009 saw the end of what was known as the third world.
This is not to make light of the extreme poverty still evident in Africa and elsewhere, but the events of the past year mean countries in the old first world, from Greece to Britain to the United States and Japan, can no longer be so confident they have the healthiest economies and the best chances of continued prosperity. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
We've been talking recently about Americans' lack of trust in Congress. One reason is that many people think lawmakers pay too much attention to special interests. NPR's Peter Overby has this report on the special interest problem and how it's so obvious corporate lobbyists are using it against each other.
This is about the never-ending battle between Federal Express and UPS and a legislative provision to knock out one of FedEx's competitive advantages, its non-union drivers. The FedEx lobbying campaign has some offbeat web videos tagging the provision with that modern epithet, bailout. The videos feature a long-haired dude, definitely a dude, representing UPS.
As you can see, I'm here in the nation's capital and I'm looking for a bailout. I mean, everybody else is getting one. Why not me?
The provision isn't a bailout that would throw taxpayer money at UPS. What it would do is give unions a better shot at organizing the truck drivers at FedEx Express, the part of FedEx that ordinary consumers use. FedEx Express is an airline, top to bottom. It avoids the labor law that regulates UPS and other trucking companies. So, while UPS drivers all belong to the Teamsters Union, the law for an airline, such as FedEx Express, makes it much harder to unionize. The provision would effectively reclassify FedEx Express drivers as non-airline employees. Ken Hall directs the Teamsters unit for delivery truck drivers.
I mean, it really boils down to this. When you receive a delivery from a FedEx driver, it's not a pilot, it's a driver. They don't fly in or land their airplane and deliver the package. It's a driver, just like everyone else in the country receives them.
This legislation was written by UPS for UPS and benefits only UPS.
Mari Lane is director of FedEx Corporate Communications.
Who it hurts is the consumers and it hurts taxpayers. And it actually takes a lot of people's confidence out of government.
Yeah, you know, this is one of those crazy things that you see in Washington. And when you learn more about it, you really can't believe what's going on.
UPS spokesman Malcolm Berkeley says it's FedEx that's committing lobbying malpractice.
Once again, the American public and Congress is being fed a bunch of lines by a company that will do anything to maintain its special interests.
But the fight involves more than just the content of the provision. FedEx also attacks the way congressional Democrats moved it forward. It's in a big aviation bill that has funds for a long-delayed overhaul of the air traffic control system. The bill passed the House last year. Now it's a must-pass item in the Senate, where Republican Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, FedEx's home base, says he'll block the whole thing if the FedEx language is in it. So the lobbying dollars are flying on this one. It's a top priority for all three players. Since January 2009, UPS and the Teamsters together have spent $11 million on Capitol Hill, and FedEx has spent $21 million. Mari Lane says FedEx has done polling.
We found out that 9 out of 10 Americans don't like special interest legislation like this, and that Congress, with the very low popularity it has, should stay away from these kind of things.
But Congress can't stay away. In fact, back in 1996, senators were arguing this precise issue, but in reverse. Language to protect FedEx Express from the unions was put into a must-pass aviation bill. Massachusetts Democrat Edward Kennedy tried to block it.
Federal Express will have another weapon to turn its back on the legitimate rights of workers and workers' rights. And that, finally, is what this is all about.
Kennedy failed. And 14 years later, the two companies, the Teamsters and Congress, are at it again. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Showdown time in the U.S. Senate this weekend. Lawmakers on the Banking Committee say they're working through the weekend to get a bipartisan agreement on new rules for Wall Street by Monday. That's when the financial regulatory overhaul is up for a key procedural vote. As NPR's Audie Cornish reports, the rancorous political atmosphere from the healthcare debate still lingers over negotiations.
For months now, lawmakers have been saying that debate over financial regulations would be nothing like health care, that there was 70, 80, 90% agreement on what should be in the bill, and with just a little more time, a bipartisan proposal could emerge. Well, it looks like time is almost up.
You know, I think by all accounts, most people felt like we were almost completed. The analogy that's been used is we were on the 5-yard line. And the lights went out.
That's Tennessee Republican Senator Bob Corker, who was at one point working toward bipartisan legislation. But while party negotiators on the Banking Committee are still lobbying for time to reach an agreement, party leaders on the Senate floor appear a lot less interested.
This kabuki dance we've been involved in for months now.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
This game is apparent to the American people. My friends on the other side of the aisle are betting on failure again, as they did with health care, as they have done everything this year. Health care was not Obama's Waterloo. Maybe they want this to be his Waterloo, but it's not going to be.
Senator Reid says the first lesson he's learned from the health care debate is not to put too much stock in calls for bipartisanship. So he's plowing ahead with a crucial test vote on Monday night to take up the bill. He'll need 60 votes, and he only has 59 in his caucus. Meanwhile, the GOP minority leader Mitch McConnell has gotten commitments from all 41 Republicans that they won't vote to start debate if the bill stays in its current form. Republicans particularly oppose a proposed $50 billion fund for winding down failing firms. They say loopholes in the bill could encourage regulators to keep a financial firm on a sort of life support. McConnell says that could result in the kind of bailouts Americans fear.
The first thing they want us to prove is that this bill ends bailouts. That was the one thing this bill was supposed to do, the one thing it was supposed to do. And if this bill didn't do anything else but that, a lot of people would be satisfied. The administration said it wants to end bailouts. I say to them, prove it.
Democrats say the fund paid for by banks is for liquidation, not rescue. And this leads to another lesson of the health care debate, says New York Democrat Charles Schumer, define or be defined.
Bottom line, on the health care bill, we allowed too many lies to get out there without rebuttal because we thought they were so obviously untrue.
Democrats in the Senate and the White House say the fund isn't central to the bill, but they've replied with fiery rhetoric just the same.
We've learned our lesson, And the minute these things come out of the mouths of some of our Republican colleagues, we rebut them. And we rebut them again and again. And fortunately, these lies are not taking hold.
As for those bipartisan negotiations, what's the holdup? Well, lawmakers are trying to work out how much power the proposed Consumer Protection Bureau should have to write its own rules and how far states can go in enforcing them. They're also looking at how to merge competing provisions dealing with the derivatives market. And besides the $50 billion bank fund, there's also a contentious proposal to bar banks from doing trades with depositor money. If these issues aren't hashed out over the weekend, lawmakers outside the negotiations are lining up with amendments to tackle them on the Senate floor, if the bill gets there. Audie Cornish, NPR News, The Capitol.